From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2011, beginning in rural Guatemala. 14-year-old Adelina Aguilar made the 6-week journey along what is known as the Migrant Trail. She was largely alone, leaving her parents and her 9 younger siblings behind in the highlands of her homeland. Her journey took her on Mexican trains, mostly freight trains, from Chiapas all the way to the northern part of the country. Adelina was part of a small group, and one day a man in the group tried to rape her. With the help of the only other woman in the group, Adelina fought him off. The woman was screaming, "She's just a baby." Finally, Adelina reached the South Texas wilderness, and for 4 days she walked toward the United States border, trying to stay away from her assailant in the group. She passed human remains along the way. Adelina was one of thousands of children from Central America who came across the border. That story comes from Mother Jones Online, and today the Washington Post estimating that between October of last year and June of this year, 52,000 children have come to the country unaccompanied by their parents from Central America. It has become a crisis, and the conversation about where those kids should go has come to Western New York. We have a panel that will cover all sides of this issue this hour. John Lori Gertner is the director of the Greater Rochester Coalition for Immigration Justice. Lori, nice to see you.
Thank you, Evan, for having me.
Daniel Reichman is an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Rochester. Professor, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Later this hour, we're going to hear from Congressman Chris Collins, and we'll speak to a reporter who's covered border issues for years for KJZZ. And joining me as co-host for the hour is my colleague here at WXXI, Michelle Faust, who's covered not only immigration issues for years, but been following this particular story closely. Michelle, nice to have you in studio with me.
Yes, thank you very much.
And this is one that, again, for a lot of people, it's a brand new issue. For you, in general ways, you've been covering immigration, but this is one that has been building. I mean, this didn't come up overnight, but what we have seen is an influx in the number of children that's greatly spiking now, and a lot of people talking about a crisis.
That's right, and our listeners know that I'm fairly new to WXXI. I came here from KAWC in Yuma, Arizona. I, with Border Patrol and on my own in many stories, I traveled pretty much every inch of the Yuma sector border, and I can speak to that from my own experience as a reporter. Right now, we're talking mostly about these unaccompanied minors that are coming to the country illegally. This year, the Department of Homeland Security, that's the federal government entity that runs Customs and Border Protection, they've seen a tremendous increase in unaccompanied minors who've crossed the border illegally. Most of these children are coming from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. The government is projecting about 60,000 children will cross the border this year alone. That's this fiscal year. Compared to the fiscal year 2013, there were more than 24,000 unaccompanied minors. So that's a huge increase. The Department of Health and Human Services are making this estimation. They're the ones that take on the children after they get out of DHS custody. And DHS has 72 hours to turn them over to Health and Human Services. So before 2012, the 2013 number I gave you, 24,000, it was half that in 2012 and averaged before that less than 7,000. So we see that this is increasing year by year and coming to a peak right now. These children are crossing for many reasons, and they're identifying as them escaping violence from their home countries. They're trying to reunite with their family members that are in the United States to come to work, and some of them are being human trafficking rings are bringing them into the country. Now, I already mentioned that HHS, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, is taking on custody of these children. These children are not being given refugee status, but someone has to take care of them, because if they're unaccompanied minors, it is our obligation to make sure that they're housed and being taken care of safely. They're housing them and trying to move them through the system as quickly as possible. Yesterday, the president spoke about how he wants to have these children deported as quickly as possible, but it has to be done in a safe manner. Now, HHS reports that the children are being housed on average less than 35 days. And right now they're in temporary shelters in Texas, California, and Oklahoma. There are some other shelters that are being HHS and DHS are working together to house them. Jude Jaffe Block, who we'll be speaking to later in the hour, has already toured the facility in Nogales, and that's where most of the big stories were coming out of just late last month. So we'll hear about that. There are some locations in New York State that they're looking at to bring people, these young kids, to in New York State. They've looked at some locations in Buffalo, Greece, and Brockport, but As of today, all of those have been deemed unsuitable. What's clear is the federal government is overwhelmed by this influx of children.
Yeah, everything I read indicates that this is a federal government that was prepared for 6,000 to 8,000 kids a year, not 50,000 to 80,000 kids a year. Everything in Western New York indicates that political leaders are saying, not in my backyard. And so I know there's so many different places to go with this conversation, and we're going to do it comprehensively this hour. Maybe we start with Professor Reichman, who can help us understand the whys of this. You know, Professor, again, Michelle touched on why children are coming across the border from essentially mostly these three Central American countries. She talked about violence, for an example. Give me an example on the violence side. They're escaping some rough situations in their homeland.
Yes, that's certainly right. There's been a very dramatic increase in gang-related violence throughout Central America in the last 10 years. And that's certainly one of the important contributing causes to this upsurge in migration. I also think it's important to remember that though we are in a crisis, it's a crisis with deeper historical roots. These countries have depended economically on migrant remittances for, in some cases, 20 to 30 years. And so certainly when things get more desperate and more violent in those countries, it's going to lead to an increase in migration, but we can't isolate that as the lone cause.
And you say, again, for so many of us, this is an issue we're trying to get up to speed on in the last week. How far back does this go?
Well, we've seen high levels of migration from El Salvador and Guatemala beginning in the 1980s. There were very, very violent civil wars in both countries that generated large numbers of refugee flows coming north. Many of those immigrants came as undocumented immigrants and were then legalized after a 1986 law, and their relatives then became eligible as legal immigrants. Now, the case in Honduras is slightly different. Honduran migration didn't really begin in high levels until the late 1990s, particularly after Hurricane Mitch, which was a huge natural disaster in 1998. And it really peaked in the mid-2000s. And if you look at Honduras now, it's the country that's most reliant economically on remittances from migrants in the U.S. It accounts for as much as 20% of the entire economy.
Let me explain for our listeners who don't know. A remittance is when money is sent back from the United States to countries wherever the immigrant person is coming from. And, you know, Mexico, that's been a very large part of their economy for many years, and Central America as well. During the economic downturn, remittances went down to nearly zero. But now they're going up again. Isn't that right, Professor?
That is right. And in fact, remittances to Honduras in particular didn't really go down during the recession. They certainly did to Mexico and to other countries, but they've increased, and they've increased pretty dramatically in the past 2 years. Increase from 2013 to 2014 has been somewhere between 9% and 10%. So the money that people are sending home, the numbers have gone up even in the aftermath of the worst recession since the Great Depression, and that just indicates how reliant these countries are on jobs in the United States.
And Michelle, you mentioned smuggling as another reason. And I want to make clear, at least from what I'm reading, and maybe the professor can help me out here, smuggling networks can be voluntary or involuntary, correct?
That's right. There are many ways that a person can be smuggled from Central America into the United States, all of them very dangerous and expensive. It's important to remember that Central Americans also have to cross through Mexico, and they are undocumented immigrants there as well. And there are Mexican immigration authorities that are trying to remove them as well. And so they have to cross two borders if they're coming from Honduras, for example. I've met and talked to human smugglers, and in some ways, they act a little bit like travel agents in the sense that there are different packages that people can pay for different kinds of services, and they rely on a network of organized crime throughout the region that helps move people from point to point. So it's not as if one person just loads up a van of people in Honduras and drives through Mexico. It requires a very sophisticated amount of organization all across the region.
Are you paying more for more protection?
Yes, for more protection.
There's no safe smuggling, but sure.
Right. There are better coyotes, which are smugglers, and worse coyotes, and the people that have more money to pay tend to get coyotes with better reputations. I should point out that the cost has declined in the last few years from about $7,000 to $8,000 from Honduras to the United States to somewhere between $3,500 and $4,500 per person, and the cost for a child is actually less than it is for an adult. So that's also playing a role.
And let me ask Michelle and Professor Rackman, because, again, Michelle, you've covered this issue for years, and, again, I feel very new to it. Professor, you can help me as well here. We've talked about the reasons. We've talked about violence in Central America, fleeing violence. We've talked about economic opportunity. We've talked about reuniting with families here. And then the question of why so many children are here, we'll never know exactly the breakdown of how many are here because of violence, how many are here because of smuggling, how many are here because their economic opportunity. Is there a single largest factor that we know, or do we know generally how it breaks down?
No, I'd like to get your perspective on that.
Well, I think poverty is the single largest factor. I think that we have the most dramatically unequal border between the United States and Mexico that exists anywhere in the world. And a person, a young Honduran person out in the countryside might be able to earn $3 or $4 for hard labor over the course of a day. Now, if they think of themselves making $10 to $12 an hour in the United States, that's an unimaginably large sum of money, and it makes the risks worth the potential rewards.
Mm-hmm. Well, my colleague Michelle Faust has been able to be in contact with some other reporters who are on the southwest border, and this is an opportunity for us to expand our conversation. Michelle?
That's right. On the phone, we have Jude Joffe Block, and Jude Joffe Block is a reporter with KJZZ. It's an NPR member station based out of Phoenix, Arizona. She's also a reporter for Fronteras, the Changing America desk. That's a southwest multi-station cooperative that covers issues about immigration and the border. Jude was one of the reporters that toured the detention facility in Nogales, Arizona last month. And Jude, we'd like to hear from you a little bit about what you saw there in the facility in Nogales that was housing so many children.
Yeah, well, it was interesting for me to see that facility after interviewing several people who'd already gone inside before they let media in. And so I kind of knew what to expect, which was that it would be these cages inside. I mean, it's a big warehouse that is divided up with these holding cells, basically, that are fenced. And so then there's children of different age groups and different gender segregated into these areas. They do have showers set up. They have a whole health facility for vaccinations and medical screenings. But it's really different once you're actually seeing children. You're seeing their faces. Some of them were teary-eyed, looked like they'd been crying and looked distraught. Others were sort of sleeping or watching television. You see this area with their property, with the backpacks that they came in with, and it's hard not to see some of those pink backpacks and think about, you know, what was going through that child's head when they packed that backpack and decided to make this journey, and is it what they expected? And what kind of fate are they going to wind up with? Are they going to be sent back? Are they going to stay? And what kind of life awaits them? You know, we really don't know at this point.
Now, it's my understanding that you were not allowed to speak with the children when you were able to tour that facility. But do you get a sense that these kids were separated from their parents along the journey, that they were looking for their parents when they got to the United States, or that maybe something happened to a parent?
Yeah, I think in most cases, I mean, a lot of these kids are coming with other children, or sometimes they're coming with other relatives. And if it's not a biological parent, that's at what point they could get separated into this facility. So if they're coming with an older sister or an aunt, they might wind up being classified as an unaccompanied minor because they're not with a biological parent. So I think it is a mix of circumstance.
You used the word, Jude, you used the word cages, and I actually had a bit of a shudder when you used that word. It sounds very crude, but for those of us who have never seen a facility like this, that's not hyperbole, I guess.
Well, I mean, it is a fenced-in area. I mean, and this area was designed, this warehouse was designed originally to temporarily house adults, and it does have barbed wire at the top of this fence, some of these fenced-in areas to discourage climbing over. So I think it does look more severe and jail-like than perhaps if it had been designed with this population in mind. You know, this was a really you know, the federal government scrambling to find a place to put these people because there had been that surge. And apparently, you know, the infrastructure that we had on the ground wasn't adequate to meet those numbers. And so this is the result. And I mean, if it were a hurricane shelter or some other place that somebody might be in a disaster, you know, I think logistically they've done a really good job. It is just a difficult situation given the difficult circumstance of these children.
Now, these locations are just overpopulated. I know that they're looking for places. They've already established some locations in Southern California. And they've looked at several sites here in Western New York. And none of them have worked out. But it sounds like all of those locations were very similar to the one that you described, that they were warehouses that they were hoping to just quickly turn around and make them housing facilities. And basically, that's not happening. But the government is obviously in a situation that they have to find a place.
There has to be somewhere, right, Jude? I mean, from what you're seeing there, we may say not in our backyard, and you're going to hear that from political leaders later this hour on our broadcast, but it has to be somewhere, right?
Right, and what's really causing the bottleneck, I mean, it is not only it's the huge numbers coming in, but it's the ORR, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, has these shelter facilities, which are supposed to be the longer term, and that's more of a comfortable home setting for these children, that's a more appropriate setting, and they're supposed to be transferred into that custody within 72 hours. There was a bottleneck in that there wasn't enough bed space in those shelters, which was causing the need for Lackland and San Antonio, the need for the Ventura Naval Base, and the need for the Nogales facility that I visited. You know, these sort of emergency stopgap measures. So the Nogales facility that I saw is only meant to hold children for a very short time before they can be sent somewhere else. But we need, the country needs to figure out more shelter space, and that those can be anywhere in the country. And we have been seeing pushback from various communities that don't want those longer term shelters in their backyard. So that is a really complicated issue.
Talking to Jude Jaffe Block from KJZZ on the southwest border. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the question of unaccompanied minors, the more than 50,000 from October through June this year, according to the Washington Post. And so, Jude, everything I read indicates that most of them, three quarters or more, are boys. And most are 16 or 17 years old, but at the same time, that's not all of them. There are some very young children, as you've indicated as well, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, so they've been seeing the most recent trends is that the population is getting younger and has gotten younger in the past several months and has gotten more female. So those are trends that they've been seeing just recently. And then another element is that some of these are young mothers. So some are teenage mothers who have very small infants with them. So that's why there's sometimes children as young as 1 year old or something like that in these facilities.
And let me ask Jude and Michelle this question again, a pair of reporters, Michelle with us at WXXI, Jude at KJZZ, who've covered immigration issues for a long time. And we heard from John Boehner and Republicans in one sense blaming DACA. And my understanding is that DACA wasn't even announced until about 2 years ago, June 2012. And the influx of these unaccompanied minors started well before that, I think. So I'm not sure if, but maybe Jude or Michelle, can you help address what DACA is and what some of this part of the blame game is? So, we'll start with Michelle.
Yeah, DACA is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And that was, like you mentioned a couple of years ago, that was announced by the president. And that was an executive order that allowed provisional status for young people. I know that Lori's worked with a lot of DACA young people here in New York State. That does not allow a legal status, but it's kind of a temporary status for people who've come to the country, brought here by their parents before they were of a certain age. I believe the age was 12 years old. Is that correct?
31.
They have to be younger than 31, but they had to have come across the border with their parents
16
before
place.
The age of
yeah.
16. And so there's some rumor that people are misunderstanding what DACA is and may be coming. I'm not sure, you know, that may have been twisted. It's not sure. It seems like people from different political spectrums are trying to use that to their own devices. I'm not sure what your perspective and what you've learned from some of the people that you've spoken to about what role DACA and some other immigration rules have had. Jude.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a really interesting issue, the whole role of rumors in all of these trends that we're seeing. And it's really hard to pin down exactly what message is getting out and why. I mean, certainly at the Nogales facility, some of the Border Patrol agents, for example, the head of the union there, the union president at the Tucson sector, told reporters that the Border Patrol agents are doing interviews and they're hearing from children that religious groups have encouraged them to come before the end of June specifically because they would be allowed in. And you know, so one interpretation is that perhaps that was a DACA misunderstanding because there was a DACA deadline that had to do with a whole different population of people that maybe had been fumbled somehow, and that was why word got out. Other people are saying, well, word is getting out to go because situations are so dire and people are going anyway, that the word that's spreading is just to sort of try to help people learn how to manage the system. Others are saying that it's smugglers who are exploiting a loophole that allows that basically because we have a humanitarian system set up for children where they don't, if they're not from Mexico or Canada, that they don't get deported right away, that they have a chance to be in this country and fight their legal case and often end up reunited with parents in the meantime, that smugglers have exploited that to really kind of spread the word and try to get as many clients. So there's a whole lot of narratives out there, and it's really hard to pin down what exactly is going on. We do know that this trend of unaccompanied minors more and more coming each year has been going for quite some time. And it is interesting, though, why if it was just DACA related, why it would come right now, and also why there'd be such an increase right now. And it's also unclear why it wouldn't be from more countries, because we're really seeing an overrepresentation from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador.
And for clarity, the DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, does not cover these kids, whether or not that's a belief in Central America.
Right. Jude Jaffe Block, thank you for taking the time and for joining us on the program here live. Thank you for your perspective.
Thank you.
Reporting from KJZZ, and Michelle and Jude have been covering the story. So we're thrilled to have Jude's perspective. Before we get to a break, I want to bring in John Laurie Gertner, the director of the Greater Rochester Coalition for Immigration Justice. Now, Laurie, we've been talking about the whys. Why do we see this influx of children? We're starting to get a feel for that. And then there's been the question, especially over the last week or 10 days, of are there facilities in Western New York? It was sort of quickly rejected when that came up. What's your organization's position on what to do? We can talk about how to stop this inflow going forward, but there are children now who have a lot of needs. What does your organization want?
Evan, our organization is quite concerned about this, and as much about the rhetoric that's going on around it as anything else, because it's the rhetoric that is keeping us to do what our historical perspective has and should have been, and that is to protect those who have been in trouble throughout the world. These kids are greatly in trouble, as has been discussed earlier. They're fleeing violence, they're fleeing persecution in their home countries, they're leaving their home countries, trying to find their family members who are up in this country. We hear reports of this almost every day now. Our organization, and I think the other organizations that we work with, would quite clearly say that it is our obligation as American citizens, as a country, to do everything we can to support the safety of this entire population of children.
And that means potentially opening up facilities in Western New York?
That's correct. That's absolutely correct, and I think we'll probably talk about that later after we've heard from...
Yeah, we're going to hear from Congressman Chris Collins, but it does appear that that issue was floated and quickly became a non-starter. Michelle, I think part of my observation on this discussion in the last week is that people immediately said no to that without fully understanding the issue, and I'm part of that, by the way. I mean, I'm still learning about this issue, but I think a lot of that was a knee-jerk reaction that said, not here. That's from what I was hearing.
Well, but it sounds like all of the locations that they've been talking about, especially in Oklahoma, a lot of the things that I've read, that they're saying, you know, not in our backyard. But the truth is, at the end of the day, they have to find locations. HHS, you know, may still be looking for places in Western New York, but most of the places that they were looking at very seriously were rejected quickly, a lot of the time because they were facilities. And when we spoke to the supervisor for Greece, he was saying...
Rylik, yes.
Rylik, exactly. So Rylik was saying this is not a facility, the Kodak facility there in Greece, not a facility that is suitable for humans, for people. He said this is just a warehouse facility, but they're trying to move quickly to turn things around, to have a place to put these kids.
Well, and Lori, quick reaction to that. You got Supervisor Rylik saying, look, this facility doesn't work. So how can you advocate for a facility that's not suitable for children?
That's a big question, and that's a question of capacity and the ability to support these children. You can't warehouse them. You have to put them in a place that's safe, both for their physical well-being, but also for their mental health. You can't just lock people up someplace.
And go ahead, Professor.
Another aspect of this that hasn't been discussed is that it's very difficult for undocumented parents to come out and claim their children. Many of them don't have driver's licenses. They live in fear of presenting themselves to immigration authorities, and to just pick up the phone and say, this person is my child, they're putting themselves at risk of being deported, and that makes the problem even more tricky.
Well, and two questions on that line. Michelle and I were speaking earlier today about the question of, and I had the question that I still don't fully know the answer to, there are a certain number of these children who we really don't know who they are because they don't necessarily tell you, they don't have identification, they're not with their parents. But Professor, is that true for some of them?
Yes, I think that's certainly true. They're going to do what they need to do to protect their relatives here.
Right. And you can't deport a child if you have no real idea where they're coming from.
They will have some documentation. They need to have a notarized document from a relative in order to cross from Honduras into Guatemala, for example. So in the process of being smuggled, they will have some kind of paperwork with them, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be accurate. There are many forgeries. There are many attempts to connect people through kinship to legal citizens to help their cases. So it's very, very complicated.
And in that journey from Honduras, if we're talking about Central America, getting all the way across Mexico and getting across the U.S. border, those are things that can be lost.
That's right.
Let's take a very short break. We're going to come back. We're going to hear from Congressman Chris Collins and continue our discussion about what happens to these children, U.S. immigration policy, what is the president saying, and what do the local advocates want to see, whether it's here or somewhere else across the country. That conversation continues on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, let's go caving. It's much more than just a casual stroll through a wide opening in the earth. It's about a culture that seeks to discover the inner pores of our planet. Then, we're all about Belgium. We celebrate the World Cup match between the USA and Belgium by diving into Belgian culture and Belgian beer. That's coming up next hour on Connections.
I'm Robin Young. Qatar negotiated that trade of Taliban detainees for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. But what about other Americans being held hostage overseas?
It would naturally lead all the families to wonder, can we indeed negotiate with terrorists to make a swap or to get someone out?
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBR Boston.
This afternoon at 2.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. You want to join the conversation about unaccompanied minors, it's a toll-free number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. In studio is John Laurie Gertner, the director of the Greater Rochester Coalition for Immigration Justice, and Professor Daniel Reichman, anthropology professor at the University of Rochester. My colleague Michelle Faust is co-hosting the hour with me covering this issue. And here's Jenna on Twitter who says, it is not our obligation. Send them home. Close the border. Lori, even if Jenna says, even if she acknowledges this is sad, we don't want to see children hurting, but we can't do it all. Close the border and send them home. What do you say to that?
I say it's basically, this is an unreasonable comment to a disaster situation. We opened our borders to Haitians after the hurricane there. We've opened our borders for other people. Unfortunately, we've closed our borders many times, historically speaking, during Nazi Germany, etc., the Chinese Exclusion Act, etc. This is the inappropriate response for us as a democratic nation, a leader of the free world.
But should we have a limit? Can we set any kind of a limit on what we should be willing to accept when it comes to immigration?
I don't have a clear answer for that as far as numbers, but I'm saying we cannot. We cannot send 50,000 children home. And it's not sending them home, that's sending them back to a border from which they know not where they're going.
Let's grab a phone call as well before, and then we're going to listen to Congressman Chris Collins. But this is Paul in Rochester. Thanks for calling Connections, Paul. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. An extremely very informative show today. Quick question. It seems to me a couple of years ago, because of budget cuts, they were closing military bases. Are these military bases still closed? And if so, can't they use them? Many cities have empty schools. Can these also be used? And that's pretty much my question, and I hope you're showing you do well.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate that. On the issue of military, anyone on the panel, any idea on what might be out there, Michelle?
Now, some of the locations, the one in Oklahoma and the one in Southern California, those are former military bases or partially occupied military bases. So that is something that they are looking for. But at the end of the day, they have to have the staffing to be able to come in and take care of those kids. And they have to have the location that's going to be appropriate. So I know that those are locations that are being looked at. Why they're not more that are being used, yeah. I don't have the answer to that.
I suspect there are large facilities in most states that you could choose if you had the will to turn them into some kind of a housing facility. I don't know the answer to that, but Lori, do you think that's probably right?
I don't have the knowledge about that either, Gavin, but I think it's important to raise, and that is there's a concern that these children are dangerous. And I think it's quite clear.
Yeah, some have said that maybe they might be gang members.
That's correct. But I think it's quite clear that most of these are children running away from gang issues, poverty, and violence.
Yeah. Professor, is that probably accurate?
Yeah, I think it's far more likely that Central American immigrants are going to turn out to be hardworking model citizens than they are to be potential gang members or criminals.
But there is a gang perspective here. There are gangs that are very popular. I don't want to say popular, but that have a lot of power in Central America, especially El Salvador. And there's a connection from the United States to El Salvador with especially the Mara Salvatruchas or the MS-13. Can you talk to us a little bit about the history of that, Professor?
Yes, Michelle, that's right. Starting in the 1980s, there were undocumented people from El Salvador that were deported back to their home countries who had been arrested for gang-related crimes, predominantly in Los Angeles. And when they were deported, they have very few connections in El Salvador. They hadn't grown up there. They had no social network to rely on. And they ended up reforming the gangs that they had been involved with in Los Angeles in El Salvador. So in some ways, gangs are one of the U.S.'s probably worst exports to Central America in the 1980s. And it's really come back to haunt us.
Let's grab another phone call. This is Stephen in Rochester. Go ahead, Stephen.
Yes, I'd like to say that I personally think that this whole issue is kind of like has to change from thinking from a historical perspective that the United States was a land of opportunity, because we live in a different era now. Things have changed since 1700 and the first settlers here, and we got a situation now with the world population out of control. And I know that's a different issue, but it's the roots of what I'm thinking here. It's basically saying that people in this country we've pursued zero population growth, seeing the unsustainability of world population growth. And the social changes that are taking place with citizens of this country have basically said that, well, I'm only going to have one or two kids. We've had zero population growth. But we're allowing and rewarding people to continue the type of lifestyle that's leading to this problem that is unsustainable in the long run of population growth by allowing them to continue coming in here. Things have changed. Like the Carson buggy's gone, slavery's gone. I think we got to change our immigration policy if we want to protect the children's future of citizens of this country.
Stephen, thanks for the call. And an extension of that, I'll ask Lori Gertner. His concern is largely what I hear when people say there's a moral hazard here to always sort of opening your doors and taking care of people when they come in illegally, because that will only encourage more and more of it. What do you think?
I think it's necessary to recognize that most of these children, yes, indeed, do need to be returned to their home, but they have to be returned safely. And we as a nation, which we've not discussed, and I don't think we're going to have time to, we have responsibilities in those countries as well as we have responsibilities in this country.
Yeah.
There's a lot of social, there's a lot of economic issues that we've created in that country, in those countries from which these refugees are coming.
At the end of the day, it's important to be clear. There's no talk right now of giving any status to these young people, these
right.
children. Right now they're being housed and they're being deported. So there's no conversation at the moment of allowing them to stay in this country.
And let's get to Michelle's conversation with Congressman Chris Collins, if we could. I know you had a chance to speak to him, Michelle.
That's right. Last week I spoke with Congressman Chris Collins, especially at the beginning of all this time of looking at the Western New York locations. He is a congressman whose district covers Western New York between Rochester and Buffalo, and he spoke out against the placement of these unaccompanied minors in New York State. So let's go ahead and hear from him.
Well, I think it begins, Michelle, with the fact that we have this humanitarian crisis because our president is not enforcing laws, our border is porous, and somehow in Central America, the thought is if they can get their kids across the border, in fact, it's not even hard, that when the kids are dropped off without an adult, they're trained to go find the nearest border patrol agent who then welcomes them into the United States and puts them, you know, finds them housing and starts the process of taking care of them. So it's a crisis that we have, and now it's here. What are we going to do? And the president is desperate to find places to house these refugees. And I would say they should be in Texas and Arizona. That's where they're crossing the border. They should not be in New York. You know, we have enough burdens in New York that they, I'm sure, would call this temporary, but we seem to know with the government nothing's ever temporary. And the next thing you know, our property tax owners are going to be having higher property taxes to send these kids to our schools, and it just starts to cascade. And so I think we need to cut this off right here and right now and say New York State, certainly Western New York, is not an appropriate location. They're in Texas. They're in Arizona. That's where they should stay. And by the way, let's secure our borders.
When we look at the locations and the photos of the locations that are specifically recently toured in Nogales, Arizona, those places are just overwhelmed and not enough place. They are looking for other places in California and some other states. And why specifically not New York? They do need to spread them out because they don't have enough space.
Well, let's go back to they don't have enough space because our president doesn't enforce the laws as he should, and he has sent this message to Central America: when your kids show up at the border, we're going to take care of them. So we need to secure our border once and for all. But we have the crisis now with close to 100,000 undocumented kids, refugees here. But I'm just saying, as a New Yorker, they shouldn't be in New York. And I can't tell Homeland Security or the president where they should be, but I can certainly tell them where they should not be, and that's New York.
And when you say that you're concerned with the enforcement on the border, is your opposition specifically with the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, the DACA program?
Well, that's one of it. As our president has decided what laws to enforce, what laws not to enforce, and he sends these signals, and they're, you know, it's very unfortunate humanitarian situations in some of these Central American countries. These families, through some level of desperation, are saying, let me get my kids to America. You know, President Obama is going to accept them and give them a good life in America. We just need, he has just not been firm in his policy. And, we are now paying the price for that with 100,000 undocumented kids, refugees now in the United States.
At this point, these young people are not being given a certain refugee status. Would you advocate for have them sent back to Central America or be given some sort of a temporary status or a permanent refugee status?
Well, I would say we need to sit down with the heads of those four countries and make sure they know their obligations and that the United States is not going to do this, 10,000 kids a month showing up. But it's unprecedented. It's never happened before at this level. But ultimately, they should be reunited with their families in their countries. But that's easier said than done.
That's Congressman Chris Collins, and I think it's important for me, and boy, our phones just lit up. It's important for me as the host to do a couple of things. We're going to get some reaction from our panel on this. He is, I just want to be factually up to speed here. He's inaccurate on certain points here. He said, quote, "It's not even hard for Central American kids to get across the border. Our country welcomes them, and President Obama wants to give them a good life in America." Let me start with Professor. Those things do not seem to square with what we've been talking about for this hour.
I think if you think that risking one's life to cross the Rio Grande in a raft or traveling thousands of miles on a freight train alone as a child through Mexico is easy or a welcoming policy, then you have a different definition of easy than I have.
Yeah, and he's saying President Obama has told them that they can show up, send their kids, they'll show up and they'll have a good life, and he'll give them a good life in America. Again, we should clarify. These children are not showing up and being given green cards, Michelle, right?
No, they're not. And I wanted to also mention the number. He said 100,000. Right now we're at 50,000. They're estimating 60,000 this year. You know, it might get higher than that. But right now, those are the numbers that we're looking at.
And he also used the word refugee. Michelle, that's actually an important part of this conversation.
Well, the thing about the word refugee is that it definitely has a definition. It has a definition in the dictionary of what is a dictionary, what is a refugee, and what makes a refugee, and that's usually someone who's fleeing violence in their home country. Now, it could be debated whether or not these young people are refugees. I'll let the professor speak on that. But refugee is also a status that the government gives people who are allowed to stay in the country who are fleeing violence in certain countries, and that's not right now Central America's case.
Yeah, Professor, on the refugee issue, when you hear that word, what comes to mind? Why is it significant?
Well, it's very significant because if these children are classified as refugees, then they're eligible for certain kinds of benefits and legal status that economic migrants are not. So if the congressman does indeed consider these people as refugees, then that gives them a legal pathway to refugee status to stay here in the U.S.
Yeah. It wasn't mentioned in the portion of the interview that we played, but I did ask him that. Does he believe that these young people should be given refugee status? Because he does use the word. And the congressman told me, no, he does not believe so, that he wants them deported.
But then he shouldn't use the word.
Well, but at the moment, that's not the case. But he sees it as a violent situation, and he sees the reasons why these young people are leaving. And it sounds to me, based on what he said, that he does consider them refugees, but not that they don't deserve necessarily the legal status of a refugee. I wanted to ask Lori the question because I know that your organization sees things differently. There's a lot of criticism of the president, of his enforcement of border, of the law, and a lot of organizations disagree that the president is not protecting the border or not deporting people. There are some organizations, including sister organizations to your own, that call President Obama deporter-in-chief. That's something that's been thrown around quite a bit, and saying that there are record numbers of deportations of migrants. I wonder what your thoughts are.
Yeah, Michelle, this is the paradox of this whole immigration debate, because both sides of the issues are complaining about what President Obama has and has intended to do. On both sides of the issue, we're concerned about what he is doing. As Congressman Collins has said, he's not enforcing the laws. He's not preventing these people from coming across the border. If that were the case, how would we know that there were 56,000 children who are now in our custody? That could not have happened if he was not performing his duties as the president, and the Border Patrol were not doing their duties as officers of the law. I mean, there's so many comments to be made about what Senator Collins has Congressman Collins has said, that it's nearly impossible to respond in the short amount of time, and how misguided his statements are. First of all, to make the refugee thing very clear, under immigration law, a refugee is someone who is not yet in this country. These children are here, probably will be seeking, if they are allowed due process, which is one of the problems with Mr. Obama's plan, to not allow them the due process of law, not allow them to go into immigration court, but to remove them quickly. But these children would really be seeking asylum status, and that is a totally different issue than asylum.
Let's grab some phone calls because that lit the phones up. This is Tom in Rochester. Go ahead, Tom.
Hey, Evan. This is Tom Belknap. How are you doing?
Very good. Thanks for calling, Tom.
Yeah. So I just had a comment. It may be slightly tangential, but I hear a lot of people, the comments coming in on Twitter and the people on the radio with you this afternoon, that are saying, close the borders, close the borders. And a lot of people would tell you a very reasonable response on that side would be that we are a nation of laws, and those laws need to be respected by visitors and by the people of the country. And so, sure, you need to protect the borders. The problem, though, in some respect, is that immigration policy has been a political football as long as we've had immigration policy. And it gets very lax. It's not a question of whether President Obama's doing his job right. That's a discussion, you know, to be had, but every president has had his failings. So if you, Evan Dawson, or I, Tom Belknap, shirk our responsibilities, there's a necessary penalty for that. You have to make some sacrifices, and you have to fix the problem. Now, as a nation, we've also failed in our responsibility. We haven't necessarily always protected the border. We haven't necessarily made immigration, the path to immigration, approachable for a lot of people. We've made it arbitrary. We've made it very different for different circumstances. If we're not going to uphold our obligation to create an immigration policy that is sane and makes sense, then you can't turn around and say that everybody, it's not our problem and we need to push people out. Those people have made mistakes. We've made mistakes. The question is, how do we move forward?
And you're saying it starts with real immigration reform and a much more uniform, fair system?
Yeah, I mean, in general, I feel like a lot of the response that I'm hearing on Twitter, on social, around the country, wherever you see it, seems to be less about the children who are in this specific set of circumstances, and it's more a general statement about immigration. Protect the borders, protect the borders, protect the borders. And these kids have a specific set of circumstances that need to be dealt with on their own. But also, just in general, it's fine to say we need to respect our own laws, but we have not respected our own laws. We have not made our laws, we haven't fulfilled our obligation. So there has to be some accommodation for the mess that we've created, for the confused mess that we've created, for all the undocumented workers that some of them have just jumped the border, and yes, they were wrong for doing it, but we're making a confused situation worse.
Yeah, I want to let our panel get to, and we've got more calls to get to. Tom, by the way, blogs and writes under Dragonfly Eye online, and a very interesting commenter on the Rochester scene. I want to get our panel. Let me start with Lori. He's saying that it's confusing enough to begin with here. We haven't even enforced our laws, and now we're blaming other people for being confused about it. What do you think?
Well, I think there's a lot of issues with that, but there's confusion about what the laws actually say as well. And that's a very big component of this thing, directly with these children. But we have to recognize that many of these children, by immigration law in this country that are on the books, many of these will qualify to remain in the country if President Obama will allow them their due process. There is a special immigrant juvenile status that many of these children would qualify, which would allow them to stay here and afford them the ability to be here safely.
Yeah, if I'm reading Tom's comments right, too, he's saying that we're discussing it rather abstractly when there are real human beings involved here. And I know, Lori, you've made that point this hour as well.
Yes, that's very true. These are children fleeing the issues in their own country, coming to a place that they perceive, and which I would hope that we would perceive as well, as a safe haven.
A couple other things here. Michelle, just because we've flown through the hour, we haven't even gotten to the sound bites of President Obama. He spoke yesterday. Can you sum up very briefly? Because the president has taken a rather firm stance on what's going on with the children.
That's right. So the president yesterday announced that he's asking Congress to approve $2 billion in emergency funding for border security. And he's acting on his own to redistribute some resources to focus on the southwest border. He railed against especially the House for not passing comprehensive immigration reform. Comprehensive immigration reform was passed by the Senate about a year ago this week by the U.S. Senate. Our senator was one of the Gang of Eight that worked on that. I spoke to both of the Arizona senators while that was going on, Senator Flake and Senator McCain. But basically, comprehensive immigration reform is not happening. And there was a lot of money that was in that bill that was supposed to go to allow for more visas for migrant workers to come to this country legally. There was also a lot of money to reinforce the border. There was a lot of money. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but there was a lot. A huge piece of that was for border protection and border security. So he's saying, had they passed that in the House, then we would have the funding that we need on the border. Now, I want to also make another point about border security. Border security, I think Tom Belknap makes a very good point about it being a political football. But in my experience with the Border Patrol agents that I worked with on and off of the record telling me, you know, we are catching more people than ever before, and that is because we are securing the border. Some of them say, no, a lot more are getting past us than even that we're catching. But it's really a hard thing to gauge. How secure is secure enough? Do you have to catch 100% of the people to know that the border is secure? It's hard to guess.
And Jim in Rochester, Bernard in Fairport, we've just got buried behind it. Couldn't even get to all the calls and comments this hour, and there's obviously a lot of interest. But I do think that our panel has helped really explain a lot of the why of what's going on with the children. And now there are a question of what happens going forward. But I know there's a lot of children involved, and we'll be following this. Lori Gertner, thank you for taking the time. Nice to see you.
Thank you again, Evan.
From the Greater Rochester Coalition for Immigration Justice, and Professor Daniel Reichman from the University of Rochester, thank you for taking the time.
Thanks for having me on.
Michelle Faust, great work on this, and thanks for co-hosting with me for the hour.
Thank you.
Short break, and right back with a very different second hour on Connections.